844-967-2789-844-96-PARTY.
I cannot not laugh when you do that.
It's easier to remember.
I know, it's just party.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin on this Thursday, April 27th, noon lunch hour. And earlier this month, a powerful and shocking investigative report came out from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a young woman who died after reporting domestic violence and abuse many times to the Milwaukee Police Department. And there's been multiple. There was the original piece. I think there's been six or seven pieces in conjunction with that. And it really showcases how people can slip through the cracks. And as far as how domestic violence victims sometimes don't know where to turn, even to the people who are supposed to be there to help. So our guest for this half hour is the investigative reporter who wrote the story and all the follow-up stories on Milwaukee Police Department's reaction, Ashley Luthern. Thanks for joining the show, Ashley.
Thanks for having me, Kristen.
So I want, before we start, because I want to warn anyone who's listening right now that we are going to be talking about domestic violence, and if it's triggering, come back later, because we have happier topics later in the show, but just want to give people a heads up as far as what the topic is at hand, and it can be hard for people to listen to. But I guess let's start, because the piece is thorough. It's long. It is meaty. There's a lot to it. And so as far as for people who maybe missed it, what happened to Bobby Lee?
Sure. So Bobby Lou Scheffling was mother of two boys. She lived in Milwaukee for the last several years of her life. In the summer of 2020, she began dating a man named Nicholas Howell. And he was not the father of her children. And that's relevant because later on, there'll be some questions as to whether or not their encounters were classified as domestic violence, because there are some strict definitions of what domestic violence is legally. And so they begin this relationship. And I do want to note that Mr. Howell has since been charged with homicide and her death. He has not been convicted. He has only been charged. He is presumed innocent under the law. But what happened in particularly the 10 months leading up to Bobby Lou's death last summer was that she and her friends and family made a series of reports to local authorities, both the Milwaukee Police Department, Butler Police Department, the Department of Corrections, because Mr. Howell was on extended supervision, and did have an open warrant for an unrelated offense dating to March of 2021, when he was stopped and then fled a police stop in Germantown. And so even before Bobby Lou reports any domestic violence, he has two open warrants, one related to the fleeing, and then one that's for the Department of Corrections, also related to that fleeing offense. And so that's important to know, because during Bobby Lou's encounters with law enforcement, she is asking for someone to arrest the person she says is hurting her. And she says, you know, you don't even really need me. He already has these open warrants. You have a legal justification to arrest him. And so probably the very first incident that happened was in October of 2021. Bobby Lou was with her sister, Tia, who I interviewed extensively for this piece. And they were planning to go out for the evening. And Tia and her sister said Mr. Howell didn't want them to do that. And so he punches Bobby Lou and he hits Tia on the head with using a pistol. And so in that very first report, Milwaukee police officers come, they take a report, they determine that it's not domestic violence because the information that they recorded, and it's unclear to me if there was a misunderstanding or a miscommunication, but the information they recorded was that the two had never lived together, even though they had, and that they did not share children in common, and that they had never been married before. And so therefore, it wasn't domestic violence. And so, for example, Bobby Lou did not get a lethality screening, which is an 11-question form that tries to gauge which domestic violence victims are at high risk for lethal violence. It's used by all agencies in Milwaukee County. It has been since 2014. So she did not get that at that time. She also did not get a referral to an advocacy organization. The case is then reviewed by the district attorney's gun unit, not the domestic violence unit. And so ultimately, Bobby Lou does have conversations with the prosecutor reviewing that case. And she says, you know, because he's not in custody, I'm very much in fear of him. I don't want to move forward with any kind of criminal charges. And so because of that, the DA's office said, we don't have enough evidence to issue the charges alone. So we're not going to issue anything in that case, in that October incident. The next kind of red flag that happens is in January of 2022. And there's a police chase in Butler. And Bobby Lou is driving and she is fleeing a traffic stop. And it later is believed that Mr. Howe is the passenger in the car. And when she's interviewed about this by Butler police a couple months later, she says her passenger held a gun to her and forced her to flee. And said that if she stopped, he would shoot her or the officer. And so she said that's why she fled and kept fleeing. And this Butler police officer was very thorough in his report. He had gotten already security footage from the Quick Trip where the initial traffic stop had started. Facial recognition from another suburban department identified the driver as Bobby Lou and the passenger as Mr. Howe. When Bobby Lou is speaking to the officer, she gives a different name for the passenger. She does not identify the passenger as Mr. Howe. So even though the Butler police officer already had run his background and asked her point blank, she said no. And when I talked to her sister about this later, she said that was almost certainly because she was in fear of him. Yeah. And her sister confirmed that Bobby Lou had told her that it was Mr. Howe who had been the passenger in that particular incident. And so the Butler police officer also had some concerns about jurisdiction. You know, the gun apparently comes out on the Wauwatosa side of 124th Street. There's a question of, should they investigate? Should Wauwatosa police be the ones investigating this? Can they even identify this person? And so ultimately, what Butler police tells me is they ran into a dead end. They couldn't find anyone who matched the description of the person from Quick Trip and the name that Bobby Lou had provided. There was no attempt in my reading of the reports to try to locate or talk to Mr. Howell, even though he had been identified through this facial recognition software, nor was there any communication to the Department of Corrections that he had been flagged in this incident. And so things kind of go quiet for a while and start to ramp up in the summer, last summer. So in June, her sister Tia calls 911. She says that Mr. Howe put a gun to her head, that she believes her sister's in danger. She asks the police to come. They do come. But, the call is first is connected. When they call back, Tia says, it's all over. He's gone. Basically, there's nothing for you to do here now. Okay. The officers do check on the address. No one answers the door. They do call back later. There's no answer. And so there's this 911 call, but there's no report filed because no one was being interviewed about it. In July, a 911 caller who is a friend of Bobby Lou's calls and reports that there's this, that her friend's boyfriend is hitting her. So the officers, this was something that I did not fully understand the scope of until actually the homicide complaint came out. Because from what I could tell was there was this 911 call and it was cleared as advised, which typically means officers haven't found enough information that a crime was committed. And so there were no related incident reports or anything like that. So I had initially assumed in my reporting that they hadn't found the 911 caller. And that they hadn't made contact, but it turns out that they did. And there actually was body camera footage that is cited in the homicide criminal complaint. And it shows that the two officers, Milwaukee police officers, are talking to Bobby Lou and her friend. I've been told they speak very respectfully to her. I've not seen this body camera footage myself, but it captures Bobby Lou saying how scared she is of this person, of Mr. Howe, and that she really believes he will kill her. And it also records her saying that to her friend who was with her, and her friend saying, like, we're going to fix this. We're going to find a way out of this. And she just says, no, he's going to kill me. And so what MPD later tells me is that the officers did not file a report because there was no new information that a new crime had been committed on that date. And that's something that I'll be curious, as we'll talk later on, MPD is reviewing a lot of things. I'll be curious if there's any more explanation that comes out about that. There's also a second call that night. She does call the officers back again. She gets two other officers to respond. They also clear it with an advise because she said he was back and making threats. And so again, there's not a report made. And this can be significant because when officers are taking reports, they are looking back and trying to see a pattern of what's going on. And so they probably won't see those dispatch calls. Then on July 15th, she goes to District 3 to report an assault that had happened in a car. And the officer does take a report. He does send it to the DA's office. They do send officers out to two addresses to try to find Mr. Howell. But this was a notable interaction that I know we'll talk more about, where the officer appeared to dismiss her and, after she left, called her derogatory names. And there's one more call that happens. And she reports another incident of violence, and she again asks officers to arrest him. She screens really high on the lethality assessment. She says yes to every single question, meaning she's very high risk. And she continues to ask police, probation agents, anyone really, to arrest this person.
Oh, such a heavy story. We're talking to Ashley Lutheran, who is an investigative reporter for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about her really powerful investigative report on a domestic violence case that she just outlined for us. And when we come back, I want to talk more about the reaction since the story came out, because I think it shows a lot of gaps in the system as far as where things got lost. And also what this sheds light on as far as a bigger issue, because domestic violence is a huge issue in Milwaukee right now. And it's such a huge part of, when we talk about crime in Milwaukee, a lot of it is domestic violence. And so as far as what can be done to start protecting victims. And so we will be back in just a minute. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair. And we are talking to Ashley Lutheran, who is a investigative reporter from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about her, I guess, multiple pieces at this point, investigative pieces on domestic violence and the death of Bobby Lou Scheffling, and kind of the cracks she fell through when it comes to Milwaukee Police Department and other systems that she tried to report the violence to, and nothing was done, and not enough was done in time to save her. And so I think a lot of people were talking about this piece, Ashley, when it came out, because it is so shocking. And so what has been, I guess, partially the public's reaction, but more importantly, the police's reaction and the mayor's reaction and the people who kind of, this doesn't make them look very good.
I think part of the strong reaction was because not only was it just so voluminous, as we just talked through, and I should mention there also were reports made to the Department of Corrections as well during that time period about Mr. Howell's possible alleged behavior. And I think what really captured people's attention was that we had video of that interaction that Bobby Lou had at District 3 with an officer there. I had domestic violence experts here locally review it and tell me what they felt like went wrong in that interaction. And I think that's really what captured the public's attention. And
I don't want that video to overshadow, like you said, the broader system failings here, because there clearly was a missed picture of a series of escalating domestic violence incidents. And that's important to figure out why that happened. But I can tell you, when I spoke to Mayor Cavalier Johnson, the day after the story posted online, he said he had already read it. He was pretty outraged. He said he never wanted to see anyone, any crime victim, let alone a domestic violence victim, treated the way that Bobby Lou was, and that he expected there to be changes, and that he expected the Milwaukee Police Department to treat everyone with respect, dignity, and professionalism as their code of conduct requires. I was able to interview Chief Norman about a week after it published online, and he did say that the department has now opened a full internal review into all of Bobby Lou's contacts with the department to see what, if you know, to see what went wrong. He wasn't prepared to say what had gone wrong without that review being done. It will include that District 3 interaction, although the department already had reviewed it when I first asked about it in December, and essentially just reminded the officer, you need to treat people with respect and professionalism. He pointed out, you know, the department, I think, has been, I think they've said, you know, we're willing to look at this and see where we can go wrong. They have continued to tout their investments in addressing domestic violence, which are very real. They have dedicated more resources to that. But the point that I have sort of made to some police sources I've talked to too is that, yes, there are all these really good resources, and yes, this still happened. And so someone can go to Sojourner and have an advocate with them and have a really well-trained officer from Sensitive Crimes take the report, or they can walk into a district station and perhaps not get that same level of police service that we all would want.
And I guess, I mean, it's good that this is what good journalism does. It raises, it exposes issues. And so it is, I mean, as horrific as it is to read that story, to know that there is a review happening is good. And as far as what the professionalism expectation is of police officers when they're dealing with domestic violence victims or anyone is there. But I guess, what do you feel like this show sheds as far as the bigger picture, as far as so many of us who do not, are not victims? Even if we have people in our lives who are, I've talked to Carmen, who is the CEO over at Sojourner House, and she's incredible. What we don't understand about what victims or domestic violence victims are going through, and where they can turn, where they can feel safe. And I feel like that's so much of what this story shows, is even when you think you're doing the right thing, it doesn't necessarily work out the way that you hope that it does.
I think there are two things that I really hope this story shows as far as that issue. The first is that I think a lot of times victims.
Oh. Did we just lose her?
We must have just lost her.
We must have just lost Ashley as far as, oh, there she is.
I'm so sorry about
that. No, you're
that.
Fine. That's all right. I was like, she was there, she's gone.
That's okay.
Sorry, I'll try to be quick because I know.
Yes, we have about 2 minutes before the break, but I just want to make sure we finish this.
Yes. So everything a victim does is to protect their safety. And if you've never been in an abusive relationship, you may not understand the choices that a victim or survivor is making. Bobby Lou is making very rational choices. It makes sense not to go forward with a prosecution if the person you're accusing is still out of custody and has the ability to show up at any time and possibly cause you more harm. And the other thing is that I think in general, we as a society, and that includes law enforcement, need to listen to victims who are telling us what they need to stay safe. I think there's been a lot of discussion of making sure that there are more advocates available, and that's great, and that's wonderful. And Bobby Lou had spoken with an advocate, but what she was asking, and which is different from many domestic violence victims, but she was asking for someone to arrest this person. And I think it is important to, and while officers did check locations for this person, you know, when they needed to find him the day after she was found shot to death, they found him. Hmm. And so I think it's important to listen to what victims are telling you they need.
That is a powerful way to end it, as far as they found him after the fact, but they couldn't find him ahead of the time.
And for anyone listening who hasn't read the piece, it is remarkable. What a great job you did, seriously. as painful as it must have been to report on, it's just so valuable, Ashley. So thank you for your work.
Thank you. And it would not have been possible without Bobby Lou's family.
And I guess just ending on, I know in the article there's links to resources that are available. Is there any off the top of your head that we should, we'll also obviously put everything in our show notes for today, but anything that you feel as far as resources that you would tell people to go to?
There are so many good resources in Milwaukee. Obviously, there's the Sojourner Family Peace Center. There's also wearehere.mke.org, which is a coalition of culturally specific providers, and the National DV hotline as well.
Perfect. All right. Well, Ashley, thank you so much for writing this story and investigating this story and spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, I'll take a short break. And when we come back, we were going to talk about the teacher workforce and what's happening to it. So stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And just a reminder quickly, on a good note, on a happy note, we're giving away Brewers tickets in the third hour of the show.
Yay!
And so stay tuned if you would like to go to the Brewers game tomorrow night at 7:10 p.m. for your chance to win. We will give that away in the next hour. But in this hour, earlier this year, the Department of Public Instruction released a new report on Wisconsin's teacher supply and demand called the 2021 Educator Preparation Program and Workforce Analysis Report. And here to talk us through some of those findings, since the teacher shortage is a very real thing that parents certainly know, but I think we all care about, is the Director of Licensing, Educator Advancement and Development Team at the DPI, Jennifer Kammerud. How are you doing, Jennifer?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you so much. And thanks for having me.
Yes. And so I felt like this, we're going directly to the source, because I think, you know, we've talked some about the emergency licensing when we talked with a representative from Wisconsin Policy Forum. But this feels like, when I was reading through the report and the findings, as someone who spent time in like marketing and sales, it feels like there's a funnel. Like there's a funnel issue as far as we have people who want to become teachers. Mm-hmm. And so they enroll in the EPP.
Yeah.
Then they need to complete the EPP, then they need to actually become teachers, and then they need to actually stay teachers. And at every level, there's trends happening. And so I thought we kind of would start from the top, as far as in the last 10 to 15 years, what has enrollment of new teachers looked like?
Sure. So there's two ways to come in and be a teacher. There's the traditional path, which most people follow, which is exactly what you just said, right? You enroll in a program and then you move through, you complete, you get a license. And the other way is really for those who already have a bachelor's degree and who are working on the job, so to speak, while they're getting their training. But in terms of the folks who are enrolling in teacher preparation programs, the numbers dropped significantly around 2011, 12, right? You see a big drop happening and then it starts to creep back up. And that was a national issue as well. We saw all across the country a drop in the number of people going into education. I don't have the reason why that we saw that all across the U.S., but I will say the good news is that our enrollments are climbing back up. The bad news is they're still below what they were in 2008-09.
Got it.
And we are in the middle of a shortage. While we're doing better than some of our neighboring states in terms of our enrollment numbers, we're not doing as well as others in terms of completion numbers. That's another story. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we have a huge retention issue for those people who leave. And so you're right. It is an issue from how do we get people in and continue to get people in? How do we keep them in? We have always done a wonderful job preparing teachers in the state. We have a reputation.
Yeah.
And in addition to wanting to keep all of our teachers, states all around us and also beyond our borders come here trying to get our teachers because they're so good.
Oh.
And so we have a few things to think about when we think about people completing programs and then where do they go. You know, I would love every person who completes a program in Wisconsin to stay in Wisconsin. I love Wisconsin. It's a wonderful state. I've lived here my whole life. But we have people, you know, we have high flyers here, and people know that our reputation precedes us. So we also have a lot of recruitment happening. And again, we have a national shortage, not just a shortage in Wisconsin.
That is, I had not thought about that as much as far as just people being poached. It's just the as far as like any profession, you know, where do you want to go and live once you're graduated? And since we're very good at training teachers, they don't always stay as much as we would like them to. And so I guess, so to back up a little bit, as far as, so we said our enrollment compared to neighbors is good. Mm-hmm. What's going on with the completion rates as far as people starting the program but not necessarily completing it?
Yeah, so what we saw that I mentioned earlier is good news is not only our enrollments climbing overall, but we have higher enrollments than all of our neighboring states. And so you would expect to see that we would also have higher completion rates because, you know, you have more enrollments, right?
Yeah.
So you're thinking, yeah, well, you know, one thing leads to the next, right? but unfortunately, we don't. Our completion rate falls. Why does our completion rate fall? You know, I'm going to say I don't have I have some thoughts, but we don't have hard, you know, data, the linking one thing to the next. I can say that in order to complete a program, you not only have to complete the coursework, right, and your field experiences, or what we call the clinical experiences, both pre-student teaching and student teaching, but you also have to complete any required tests. Now, the state of Wisconsin only requires one test. Preparation programs, different ones may require others, but as a state, we only require one test, and that is for elementary teachers, special education teachers, and teachers of reading, and that's something called the Foundations of Reading Test. So until you complete your program, and that includes passage of that test, you can't be endorsed for a full Tier 2 license. We have a tiered licensing system in our state, so Tier 2s mean you completed everything. And so, having said that, what is our passage rate on the Foundations of Reading Test? Well, we do, because we look at that in this report. And, you know, it's 54% for first-time test takers.
That seems like the California bar level. Like, it seems like very hard and low.
Well, so we looked at that.
Okay.
So that test, we're required, so we did not develop that test here in Wisconsin. That test was put into law, and it is a Massachusetts requirement for licensure. And we were required to use the Massachusetts test along with a cut score recommended by the test developer, which in this case is Pearson. And so, you know, so I looked at Massachusetts, since it's their test they developed, right, that we're using. And when I look at those who are taking the test multiple times to try to pass, our passage rate jumps up a few percentage points. So we're closer to like 58%. And then Massachusetts pass rate is only a few percentage points higher than that. So it, and so I'm looking at that going, okay, well, we have some issues here. We're not, it's not that we're not doing a good job trying to help students pass this, because Massachusetts also has challenges. So, you know, I think in looking at the data, the concerns I have are many. One is the passage rate and the impact that has on people who decide to keep trying to take the test. Or they, do they persist in the profession? They can get a tier one license, as I didn't pass everything, but I'm you know, I meet certain qualifications to be in front of people. But then you got to keep taking it every year, trying to keep that tier one license. So do you stay in a profession if you can't pass the test and can't get to your full license? I think about the barriers inherent in that test when we look at how people perform when disaggregated by race. We have stark differences.
And
it's not just in Wisconsin we see that. So that's a concern that I have. I'm happy to say, however, that Massachusetts updated their test that was just deployed in Wisconsin this year. I don't yet have data to say if our passage rates are going up now that there's a new test. I've had some initial preparation programs say, hey, we're seeing better results. But until I actually have data, I won't be able to say much about that. But that is a factor that would be impacting completion rates, though, for sure. And it may also be impacting retention rates.
It's retention rates as far as like a tier one teacher who can teach, who is allowed to teach some things,
right?
But they have to keep taking this test. So then they're like, well, I'm just going to leave entirely.
Exactly. So when we, that's one thing that is impacting completion. I also mentioned that, and again, I don't have numbers on how many people we're talking about in regards to this, but I also know that we do, because of the shortage, we have a lot of districts who are seeing a lot of wonderful student teachers. And they're like, I know you need to complete your student teaching, but maybe you want to end early and we'll hire you. And then you can complete your student teaching later. So we do have some of those conversations happening. I don't think those are big numbers. I just know that they're happening because I get the questions from people who are talking about this. But generally, the one big thing that I do know is impacting completion rates is that foundation's a reading test.
That's literally, that's what I think of. I think of the California bar, and it's like, it's a really hard test that people who have studied very hard for it are having a hard time and passing. And so we're talking to Jennifer Kammerud, who is the Director of Licensing, Education Advancement, and Development at the Department of Public Instruction about the teacher workforce and kind of the different impacts as far as recruitment, retainment. And so as far as then moving down the funnel, so past completion, and so you mentioned before, so as far as people who are getting their licenses but aren't necessarily working as teachers, is that because of how many are leaving the state, or is there also just people who decide, I went through all this work, but I just don't want to go be a teacher anymore?
We've always been a net exporter of teachers. I have to actually survey, you know, people to say, hey, you know, see if I can find out why they're leaving. But it's a competitive environment. So I'm talking to my colleagues across the country. I hear all sorts of different things that are being put forward, from higher salaries, right? Well, you know, to bonuses to come, payment of moving expenses, loan forgiveness. Like, these are things that are happening that all across the country in different states and different locations. Sometimes it's not a statewide initiative, but a county or local district initiative in different places. And they come and they say, hey, come to our state. And, you know, when you're graduating and you're looking at what's in front of you, that's attractive, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're experiencing that. The other thing I would say is, when it's hard to get your full license, are you going to try to, apply for and work on a tier one license, knowing that you're not, you know, fully licensed? It's a question. Of course, some people might be going to private schools, which is also very much a possibility, because we only collect licensing data from public schools.
Okay.
So that would be all the public schools in the state, and then, of course, the independent charter schools. So those are all public schools under the law. That's where we're collecting our licensing data from. So if you're going to a private school, some private schools require licensure and some don't, but we don't collect that information.
So then the last piece, and when we come back from the break, I want to talk about kind of solutions and where we're feeling the most shortages, but at least to finish the funnel. So then there's also highlighting how many teachers are staying past 5 years.
Yeah.
So they start becoming, they are a teacher, they're a teacher in Wisconsin. And, you know, I think I look back to some of the teachers I had, and I was in the Madison Public School District. And a lot of those teachers they had been there for a long, long time. They had spent their careers being teachers. My godmother spent her career being a fourth grade teacher. And that seems to be changing. And so is that similar as far as teachers leaving to go be teachers in other states? Or is it that more of a case when they've been teachers for a couple years and they're just leaving entirely?
We see more of that.
Okay.
I mean, I think we might be getting close to a break, so I don't want to start.
We'll get close to a break. And so, I want to be careful, because as you said, there is data and there is surveying and anecdotes as far as why this is happening. And I think when we get back from to the next break, we can talk more about that, because it seems like there's certainly policy things that we could change. Maybe there's also attitude towards teachers things that Jane and I talk about a lot on this show as far as how we treat our teachers. But we'll talk about all of that on the other side of the break. Jane, do you have any questions before? What do we have left?
Well, we have a text that I want to come back with on the other side. We were talking again about teachers and education earlier in the first hour, and I think this comment is applicable for this discussion. So we'll come back.
So
we'll come back with that.
It's a good tease, Jane. So we are talking to Jennifer Cameroon, who is the Director of Licensing, Educator Advancement, and Development at the Department of Public Instruction. If you have any questions or texts for her, we'll maybe get to them, but we don't have a ton of time. 844-967-2789. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair, and we are talking to Jennifer Cameroon, who is the Director of Licensing, Educator Advancement, and Development at the Department of Public Instruction. We're talking about the teacher workforce and shortage that I know a lot of parents are feeling. And in the first segment, we were talking more about kind of where we're losing people. And now we might get a little bit more into why we're losing people and what can be done about it. But I know, Jane, you said that we have a text.
844-967-2789. You can always call or text. That's 844-96-PARTY. I think you're all old enough to remember, hey, teacher, leave them kids alone. Now, though, it is parents and angry, random people that we need to protect our teachers from. Can't we just let kids be kids and worry about normal things like pimples? But Jennifer, I do wonder if the way that teachers were demonized during all of Act 10, and now with the extra pressure that teachers are under, they're no longer qualified to decide what books can be in their own classroom libraries. That doesn't seem like a very welcoming place to say, come and be an educator. It's great.
Well, we have a 67% retention rate for teachers in their first 5 years. We are losing teachers there and frankly, all along the continuum. And why? You're bringing up some really important issues here. So one is, of course, the expectations as well as the interactions. Mm-hmm. What do we expect of our teachers? We expect a lot of our teachers. We place our children's lives, their futures, in their hands every day. They feel that. And it's inspiring when we see the changes and the knowledge they impart. They're amazing people. And at the same time, we have all of these academic expectations. We also know that the children who are in front of them every day care deeply about their teachers mm-hmm. and have a special relationship with their teachers as well. There's trust, there's confidence, and they tell their teachers a lot of things and look to their teachers for guidance and support. That's a lot in front of a teacher. And so, putting, yourself in that space, when anyone comes to you and hurts you, frankly, because maybe not even intentionally, in the day-to-day interactions, everybody's trying to do the best job they can. And then on top of it, there's a lot of conversation about what do we trust our educators to do? How do we feel about the job they're carrying out? And how do we value them? And, kids see these conversations too. And when you think about your day, it's rewarding, exhausting, inspiring, like all those things, and emotionally hard sometimes.
Yeah.
And so you place all of that, and then all of the things that are happening all around, in the news, politics, maybe in your district, and it's a lot to take in. And so I would say, yeah, of course that impacts you. You think about your own job if you had, if you had that kind of environment around you, and you know it's a weighty role. You have a very important job. How would that make you feel? When we look across what's happening in terms of not just how do we tell teachers how much we appreciate and value the work they do, we know that they too not just feel these things, but see how we value them or don't in different spaces. One of the ways we see that, and actually all jobs do this, right? You pay people, and you give them benefits and things as a way to demonstrate the value of their work. That's every job. Everybody's got that. And so one of the things we looked at was what's happening with benefits and wages. And so the report, we look at that over the last decade. And we held it in constant $2021, so it kind of would look, make more sense, if you're looking at it. And wages and salary have gone down over the last decade by over $10,000.
Wow!
And so if you look at the end, if you think about that, we know teachers love their job overall, that they're staying in it and they're doing this for a reason, right? Because it means something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we also know that some of the things that we're hearing, and again, I don't have hard data on this. This is something we're going to be asking people. Why are you leaving?
Yeah.
We also know that people are moving out of teaching because they have families to support. They have things they need to do. I know everybody would love to pay teachers more and reward them in different ways. I also know, though, that school districts are operate under revenue limits, right? They can only spend so much money. So regardless of how much money may be put in a budget for schools, they're limited in how much they can spend, and that gets adjusted in every biennial budget. So these are all conversations that I think are really important when we have the state budget every 2 years. Like, what do we think? A budget's about priorities and what we value across multiple different areas. What are we saying in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I know, I'm excited to maybe have some of the someone to come on, because I know in a lot of the public hearings mm-hmm. that are happening right now with the Joint Finance Committee, mm-hmm. people are saying this. They're saying fund our schools. It's like, let mm-hmm. us pay teachers. And I think that makes... We expect teachers to do so much just because of the sacrifice of, well, you wanted to be a teacher, and so why aren't you willing? You get summers off, mm-hmm. which is the most ridiculous thing. Every teacher I know works all summer because that's how little they make. And so that's where I start. I think the two things that I take away from this as far as what we can do as individuals is treat teachers better. And as a policy, advocate to pay teachers more, because otherwise we're just going to continue to lose people who can make more money and support their family in other ways, even though we all need and rely on teachers mm-hmm. for our kids. And so Jennifer, you are more than welcome to come back. This was lovely. You also have like one of the most soothing voices I think I've ever heard. So I don't know, a separate future career in ASMR for you, I see, for him. But thank you so much for spending time with us today and breaking this whole report down.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, and happy to be back anytime you want to talk more.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks. Well, we're going to take a break for the top of the hour news. When we come back, we're going to talk about sports. Not a great sports week for Wisconsin, but J.R. Ratcliffe will be here from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we will break down the collapse of the Bucks, goodbye Aaron Rodgers, and the draft. So stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Rock, 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 rock
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.